So Saturday night at the monastery with another sorry, there's a chuckle in the front row. Very exciting Saturday night at the monastery. An opportunity to reflect on Dhamma. Very precious opportunity. A rare thing in the world to have the opportunity to hear the Buddha's teaching, to be able to practice it and come to a place where people are sincerely practicing, both monastic and lay people. And this weekend we have a women's work weekend happening at Casa Serena, which is going very well and very enjoyable so far. A lot of good energy over there. And, calls for, again, reflecting on the lovely qualities of Sangha, when people can come together with really wholesome intentions, not just to get something done, but to come together and enjoy each other's company, to take the opportunity to talk on Dhamma. We had some talk at tea time on different themes, which was really very helpful. It's a lovely way to create that opportunity. I have no particular idea of what to reflect on tonight, so we'll see what comes up. If not a lot comes through, I'll ask you to put forth some questions. It doesn't often happen at the monastery, but it's nice to do that sometimes. So maybe to share with you, as I usually tend to do in Dhamma talks, I usually tend to speak from a little bit, at least, from where I'm at myself, how things are developing and working through in my own practice. And I think this is helpful sometimes to share, both to break down the idealistic view that monastics have it all together, but also to, you know, to share personal experience. You know, when it comes out of one's experience, it communicates, I think, so much more effectively. And communication just isn't in words, in recollecting words of truth, but actually something that happens in the moment, the quality of the heart, the connecting that happens when we resonate with something, can resonate with something in our own experience. And, you know, the ongoing experience of making practice one's life, which I think we all attempt to do, both as monastic and lay people. It's an ongoing experience of practice. We don't call it practice for nothing. It doesn't come easily, getting the knack of letting go. when we see ourselves hanging on to that which causes suffering. You know, the forces of greed, hatred and delusion are not easy to see in ourselves because they're so familiar to us. We get driven by them a lot without even knowing it. And the Buddha's teaching around suffering and the ending of suffering is a skillful means to help us wake up to that. When we're being driven around by forces that we're not aware of, are we suffering? This is a question to ask. Is this suffering? It's a question that stops us, that pulls us up. So for me, as many of you know, you know, suffering is one of my primary reflections in practice because I find it helpful. Not only because I experience it almost continually, but I find it helpful to say, well, are you suffering? The Buddha said there's a way out of suffering, there's a way beyond suffering, and here you are just boiling in it. So, what's happening? So it helps me turn my mind and remind me, you have the capacity as a human being to wake up, to reflect on this, to see the process of craving and clinging, of grasping that which is going to burn. You know, or another kind of metaphor is like, how long do we bash our heads against a brick wall before we wake up to the fact that we're bashing our heads against a brick wall? You know, it can take a long time. That's what delusion is. That's what ignorance is. We don't quite know what we're doing. But when we see it, that's the aha experience. Oh, that hurts. Is it fruitful? Does it get anywhere? Or does it just make my head bleed? Or does it just make me burn? Does it just make me unhappy? Yeah, these are the questions we have to, and the way of investigating it, when we find ourselves caught up in the same old patterns of mind, you know, there are wholesome roots and unwholesome roots. And we talked a little bit about this afternoon. We talked about karma, the power of action, cause and effect, and the wholesome ways to act and unwholesome ways to act. And this wholesome unwholesomeness isn't just about moral ethical standards. It actually goes, although that's one aspect, but it goes much deeper in terms of what environment are we creating in our inner world and in our outer world. That which is wholesome leads to the relinquishing of suffering, leads to peace, leads to higher forms of happiness, leads to well-being for ourselves and others. And that which is unwholesome tends to lead to anxiety, agitation, unpeaceful states, and harm for ourselves and others. So this is a good, say, measuring stick of sorts to reflect on, look inwards. What kind of mind states, what kind of environment, inner environment, are we generating in our minds? You know, at any one time, with any particular set of conditions that we're working with, or what life is throwing at us at any given time, where we find ourselves, our karmic predicament. Now, our karmic predicament, in a sense, in the moment where we find ourselves living life, we can't choose that. It's a result of past karma. But right now, this is what's given. It's like this is what you dealt with. And the opportunity we have is to play out the game, or play out the hand, if you like, following through on the analogy. So this is what you dealt with, so how are we going to play with it? And that, you know, reflecting that way, we can, you know, it's a way to bring in perhaps a little bit more possibility for not only just accepting that the cards that you dealt with at that given moment, rather than saying, I wish we could do a redeal, or what so-and-so got, they always get a better deal than me. You know, this is, I don't want to play anymore, it's not fair, they cheat anyway. You know, you can kind of go on and on, but actually, first of all, accepting, okay, this is what's here, you know, whatever predicament we find ourselves in. And the opportunity we have is, okay, how are we going to play this How am I going to relate to both the predicament and the mind states that are arising around it? This is an opportunity we have. This is where we can make a difference. So for each of us, you know, this analogy, you can carry it through into whatever you're working with in your life at the moment, or reflecting on past experiences. It's a matter of being able to cultivate the qualities that can both bring clarity to the moment and a quality of calm or equanimity, that which allows the mind the space and ease to see clearly, for clarity to be present. You know, clarity, when we connect it to the quality of awareness, which it is inherently connected to, the inherent awareness, inherent clarity, it's natural. But the qualities we have to cultivate to allow that to be present, to operate fully, to see clearly, is kind of clearing the mind a bit of all the habitual reactivity. And this is where a lot of the practice is, because our tendency in trying to clear the mind, we're still getting caught up in views and opinions and ideas of how it should be done, still driven by greed, hatred, and delusion. So when we're practicing, both in meditation or dealing with any of life's little or large predicaments, first of all, remembering acceptance, coming into the moment. So this is how it is. This is what we have. And check what's happening in the mind in terms of whatever's arising in reactivity, fear, anxiety, desire. Okay, what's happening in the mind as in a response to this situation? And through seeing that clearly, rather than getting just blindly caught up in the energy or being pushed along by that energy of reactivity, to actually turn towards it and name it and say, ah, this is anxiety, this is agitation, this is frustration, or this is despair, or this is hatred, or this is desire. Whatever it is, just say, ah, it's just that. You know, our tendency, often still being influenced by greed, hatred, and delusion, is to judge the negative, the painful, and try to get rid of it. So we have to see that tendency, not even judge that tendency, you know. There's the not wanting of it. There's the fear of the fear, or the fear of the anger, or the desperation around feeling so miserable. And again, okay, this is what's present. This is how it is. Connecting the mental states, what you're experiencing mentally, with the present moment experience of the body. Bringing the body mind together is an incredible, skillful means for grounding energy and for staying in the present, and allowing the reactivity that's occurring in the body-mind mechanism to flow through, to not get caught in a sense of stuckness or holding with certain states. So using the breathing at any given time to come back, be present, ground. It doesn't mean you ignore what's happening on the mental-emotional plane, but you connect it. Connect it with the body, with the breath, because it's showing itself there at the same time. And if we allow awareness to embrace that physical realm, it actually becomes a very skillful means for grounding that energy that is stirring the mind, whether it be aversion or desire or any permutation of those. And it also gives us the opportunity to be open, if you like. I find whenever I remember to come back to my body, there's this strange moment of openness and, if you like, emptiness. And I don't always trust that. You know, the power of emotion, of greed, hatred and delusion is so enticing, so easy to go into it. You know, we can get very, we're so identified with it, we're just coerced to go along. We're tied up, our identity gets tied up in that and we move along with it out of forgetfulness. But when we remember the body, even just for a moment, as that mind turns to recollect present moment experience, the movement of the breath, the freshness, the reality of this changing, moving moment, there's a moment where there's an openness, there's an emptiness that can be recognized. You know, and as I notice that, you know, I try to encourage myself and train myself to go towards that, trust that, come back to that. And it's a place where there's no words. You know, there can be so many stories in the mind, so many convincing kind of, you know, what's going on most of the time is just basic kind of commentary with these different views and opinions coming and going, whether it's around mundane stuff or very serious stuff that we have to deal with in our lives. You know, it's just like a constant, fairly constant chatter in the mind. But that moment when you connect your attention, your awareness back to the body, bring the mind-body experience together, and you connect with your breathing, there's a moment of that silence. So we do it to appreciate that. What is that? You know, when we don't recognize it, we don't see the value in it. Mm-hmm. And this is where the Buddha is instructing us to look. When he talks in several ways, you know, we can go to the ultimate sense of things. When he talks about there is an unborn, an uncreated, an unoriginated, an unformed. If there weren't, there would be no escape from the born, the originated, the created, and the formed. He's showing us these not so much polarities, but showing us that there is something transcendent or something other than this constant realm of creation, the mental, emotional, ongoing birth and death of our experience. And he said it is here and now. It's to be discovered here and now. It's never anywhere else. You know, time is actually created. The sense of time is created out of the sankharas, the mental proliferation, the stories in the mind, the identification with the khandhas. When that, even for a moment, is abandoned, is let go of, as I was pointing to, there can be this strange sense of stopping, emptiness, silence. And I use this myself as a way to recognize, does that arise and cease? Is there any arising and ceasing in that? You know, the deathless is that which is not born and does not die. So turning your mind to the deathless element is something that the Buddha advised his disciples who are cultivating the practice, turning your mind away from that which is bound to birth and death, turning your mind to the deathless element and abiding therein. Abiding there is an opportunity to awaken completely. And yet in another way, the Buddha also talked about this famous Dhammapada quote, I think. It's, be a light unto yourself, be a refuge unto yourself. Who else can be your refuge? And I find, contrasting that with the teachings of not self very interesting. When we talk about there is no self nature, that the khandhas are not self, and yet there is this teaching, be a light unto yourself, be a refuge unto yourself. Who else can be your refuge? I find that very interesting, very interesting teachings to contemplate. There's obviously the need to know our minds, our own minds, our own mind stream, if you like. This is where we experience samsara in our own mind streams. This is where we experience birth and death, either across one lifespan or from moment to moment. And yet that deathless state is also found within. It's not found anywhere else. This refuge, he called the deathless, as the ultimate refuge. So when we're talking about letting go of that which causes us suffering, of seeing it's not self nature, seeing it as not self, it's really being able to see it as that which is subject to birth and death, that which comes and goes according to causes and conditions. This is the law of karma. Although we experience it as individual beings, there is individual karma, we can still see it as not who and what we are in our entirety. It is the result of karma, is the result of past actions. But the liberating teaching of the Buddha is pointing to the fact that you don't have to be limited by that. You don't have to limit yourself to that. But this is what we're doing all the time, and this is the cause of our suffering, is that we're identifying continually with our mental and physical experience and struggling to get it right or to get it more pleasurable or to get it the way we think it should be or to get it the way that'll make us happy. That kind of struggle happens on so many levels. From the very gross to the very subtle, I've noticed in my own practice. The gross level of just trying to get the kind of food you like, And the subtle level of just really not wanting that thought to be there. Really feeling embarrassed by that thought, That it's a sign of identification with that, seeing yourself in existence somehow in relation to that, defining self by that. So being a refuge unto yourself, I think is talking about cultivating the practice that leads to kind of mastery of the self. Mastery of the mind. That is knowing your mind so well that it doesn't blind you anymore. That it doesn't lead you into places of suffering. That's mastery of mind. And that when you've found that, that is also indicative of having found the refuge, nirvana, in that you're no longer capable of being pulled into suffering states, deluded states, being fooled by the forces of greed, hatred, and delusion. You know, so we can imagine that enlightenment might be totally free, like, you know, completely blank, void of greed, hatred, and delusion. But maybe that's not the case. Maybe those forces are still there, but we just know them so well, we don't get fooled by them. We know that's not who and what we are. And we know to follow them, to get caught up in them, just leads to suffering and harm. That's really what enlightenment is knowing that so clearly. I remember one teaching from a Thai meditation master, which really helped me a few years ago to contemplate this idea. And it was a very short teaching when he was teaching a disciple who was upset about his mind state or asking him about anger. And Lumpo Dun said, you know, defilements were in this world long before you were. Like, oh, you mean I don't have to destroy them? They're just, you know, causes and conditions. But you don't have to grab them. You don't. If you believe that's who and what you are, you get caught up in them, follow them, become them, act on them. But when you see them clearly as causes and conditions, things which arise and pass away, great freedom, not self. They're not who and what I am. We heard a poem, one of the bhikkhunis, enlightened bhikkhunis poems the other day. We were listening to a video by Jan, who gave her calm presentation on the Terigata book of poems of enlightened nuns. Just one line I remember from one of the nuns was that these poems were classically uttered after their enlightenment. One of the lines was something like, having seen that actions, speech, and thoughts are not self, I am totally free. You know, so it's actually, we don't have to necessarily get in there and change and fix up all our actions, thoughts, and speech. And even though there's obviously a skillful cultivation in being careful about what we do and say, because it does lead to creation of karma. But ultimately, the dissolving of those karmic forces is the seeing the not-self nature. That's where true freedom arises. Yet there is this refuge found within. Within this individual mind stream, and that the description that the Buddha gives in the suttas, when a person attains enlightenment, he says there's this kind of classic declaration of having, and to paraphrase, having gone beyond birth, he realizes nibbana for himself. Or each for themselves. So he's very much pointing, it's very much an individual realization. It happens within this individual mind stream. But what's realized is something that is truly beyond the confines of self, beyond the confines of this individual mind stream, of this body-mind experience, which does have a limitation. This body will die. So, you know, these different teachings are pointing to this kind of, if you like, the coexistence of samsara and nibbana, you know, in the same place. Samsara is not nibbana, nibbana is not samsara, but they are not in different places. Something that different kind of analogy that occurred to me once was that the hurricane and the eye of the hurricane are not in different places. So that stillness in the eye of the hurricane, it's not to be found by scrambling away from the hurricane, but it's found right in the midst, in the full presence, coming fully present into the midst of whatever's happening is where Nibbana is, where the eye of the hurricane is, where peace is, where the world can stop. But what it takes to come fully present into the moment, to fully embody this experience, to fully awaken, what does it take? It actually takes a dramatic letting go, quite a profound letting go. A letting go of dependence on this body, letting go of dependence on my emotions, letting go of dependence on my thoughts, my feelings, what I want, what I don't want. The Buddha talks about consciousness becoming established on objects. This is how we get born time and time again. The power of karma, consciousness becomes established on mental objects. The Nibbana is described as unestablished consciousness, mind that has abandoned clinging to any objects, no longer takes its identity from limited things, but is released, another epithet, the heart released or the mind released. Released from what? Released from that which is subject to birth and death. And we can see this from moment to moment, as the Buddha is teaching us to be investigating what is it that arises and ceases, to be able to recognize the impermanent nature of our thoughts and feelings, our views, the impermanent nature of this body, the impermanent nature of experience. It's not to deny it, but to see it in its true nature. We can never hold it. We can never control it. It never was ours, this body, mind, let alone other people's bodies and minds, or the situation, the world, the predicament. And yet we attempt, there's so much insecurity. Our attempts to control things is quite powerful. So we have to come to see that. You know, and the more we practice to see just the impermanent nature of things. I was talking with someone this afternoon, explaining how the letting go, when we see impermanence more and more clearly, the letting go becomes quite natural. We see there's no point in chasing after impermanent things or trying to control impermanent things. You know, and then the mind turns and looks at its own anxiety, its own insecurity, and has to rest with that and see, where's this mind state? How is this mind state coming into being? How is it being perpetuated? How can I be with this in a way that allows a letting go, a relaxing, an opening? In the path of this path of practice unfolds very, very naturally. I mean, my perception of my own practice and path has been one of a lot of struggle. You know, my main perception is struggle, or I should say, my main habit is struggle. And yet, you know, reflecting recently how the unfolding has happened despite that struggle or that perception of myself. That somehow, just in one's cultivation of the path, of the factors, basically cultivating mindfulness, having the intention to wake up, the desire to wake up, the putting the effort to practice, to reflect on the mind, to restrain ourselves when we know there's unwholesome things going on, and to put in effort where we need to cultivate some wholesome mind states. But actually, the power I see is more in just the willingness to know what's happening. You know, there's absolutely no possibility of waking up if we're unwilling to know what's going on in ourselves, mostly, but around us as well, but mostly in ourselves. So that kind of willingness to really see our own minds, to see ourselves, and the capacity to be with our experience. You know, see, it's not... You know, that capacity to be present with powerful emotions or with strong thoughts or feelings, that capacity develops gradually. But the power of both the willingness and of awareness itself, of the cultivation of mindfulness, has tremendous power. It doesn't seem so when you first, see, when you try to assess it, but I've seen more clearly lately that this practice is unfolding whether I think I'm practicing or not, you know, whether I think I'm doing it right or not. And you know, particularly in the monastic life, it's empowered because you can't follow your desires very much. And you're following certain structures and things that are set up, which you can think are just, you know, anathema to awakening. It's sending us to sleep. What are we doing? You can get all frustrated with monastic life. But I find actually just having to wake up in a system that's not my own creation has a power to it. You know, I just can't follow the forces of my own greed, hatred and delusion so easily. Something else is pulling me to pay attention to it. And so the structure and the whole container of monastic life is that which is pulling me that way. But if I'm willing to wake up, if I'm willing to, I'm wanting to know, wanting to be awake, then I learn very much what that process is doing. I'm being awake. And it can be painful because you're not following your own desires and you're not following what you want. And if you get caught up in that pain, indulgence in pain, then you're not really utilizing the opportunity for waking up. But as soon as I recognize recognize that indulgence and let go and turn towards what's pulling me to awakening, there's a contentment, just a moment of contentment. But it's a signal. Oh, that's interesting. You know, and theoretically, intellectually, we can say that's how it works, but we're trying to teach the heart, and the heart knows through its own taste buds, if you like. It tastes what's good, what's not good. And then I love this analogy, the Buddhism metaphor of just as the ocean has but one taste, the taste of salt, so too the deathless has but one taste, the taste of freedom. So the heart knows when it finds release, and it delights in that taste of freedom. And that's the real teaching. We have to recognize that and allow ourselves to learn by that. And we'll forget it. and we'd be get pulled back into the world and back into our own desires and creations, but something in us remembers. There's a taste of freedom somewhere around here. Just keep sniffing around. I find it. So we, you know, we pick up the teachings of the Buddha, the structure, and we train ourselves by it, and sooner or later we come upon it again, that taste of freedom. But, you know, in picking up those structures and teachings, we really have to find our own way with it. You know, it doesn't happen in a straightforward way. You'd like it to, if we just could read the teachings and practice meditation 2 hours a day and gradually find our way to the Nirvana line, get the blue ribbon, you're there. But yeah, the path's not so straightforward. Learning to wake up means really waking up to everything. And there's so many little detours we take, you know, so many little, what do you call those side pools that you get caught in? The kind of, well, eddies, the eddies, you know, the stagnant waters off the side, or you get caught in these eddies for lifetimes, you know, and spun back into the stream. So it's, you know, waking up is it's obvious, it's the hardest thing in the world to do, and yet the simplest when we really connect with what it takes. Simplest because all it requires is be present, wake up, you're already here. But it's in the forgetting that we get pulled back into the world of time and space, and the me's and my's, the I's and mine's, the us and them, the world of duality. That's where the complexity is. So it's not an easy path to navigate, whether, you know, especially if our lives, whatever work we're involved in or family lives, requires our attention in many, many different areas, can appear quite complex. But the practice is always the same. Just waking up to where you're at. Recognizing, accepting the cards that you're being dealt with in this moment, in this hand. Okay, this is where we are. This is what we've got. How do we want to play this one? And we gradually learn over time how to be compassionate with ourselves. You know, I think we learn the strength of our own views, I think, by how we treat ourselves. You know, the way we hold our own the weight we give to our own views, our own principles, even if they're wholesome ones. They can still trap us. They can still torture us. So even with wholesome states, the Buddha encouraged us to cultivate letting go. Even of Nibbana. And do not cling to Nibbana. It's equivalent to having used a raft to cross a stream, and then feeling like you have to carry the raft on your shoulder for the rest of your life. This is clinging to Nibbana. You know, so the release that the Buddha's pointing to is very much around how we conceive of ourselves, conceive of self. And any concept of self, no matter how wholesome or exalted, if clung to, is still death-bound, is still caught in samsara, is not is not the freedom that's possible. So this I find very liberating. Just to contemplate that teaching. So we find as the path unfolds, or at least in my experience, and maybe it's different for everyone, but I find it requires of me more and more faith, which is a challenge for me. More and more faith to be in the unknown, in not knowing. Willingness to be present, but not knowing. It's a very vulnerable place, isn't it? Willingness to be present without holding on to anything. Willingness to be present with painful experiences without wanting to run away. Or maybe willingness to be present with the wanting to run away but not running away. That was a Pema Chodron's definition of fearlessness. It's not being without fear, it's feeling the fear and stepping forward anyway, which I found very helpful and very pertinent. So being with the not knowing, you know, this idea of having more faith, doesn't mean we have to become so stupid that we just can't do anything in that not knowing. It's a place of not knowing that actually can allow intelligence to fully function. Intuitive intelligence, responsive, sensitive, heart-based intelligence. To me, that's the place of wisdom, where wisdom is balanced with compassion. Where it's not obstructed by preconceived notions, views and ideas, but is willing to be present, awake and responsive. Willing to make mistakes, because we're human. Willing to bear the consequences of our actions, whether pleasant or painful. Willingness to learn, but ultimately just willingness to continue to let go or to not cling. Remember Ajahn Sumedho saying that at first the path is about letting go, and later on it's just about non-attachment. So there's a bit more of an activity of letting go of that which we feel stuck to. And then it's a matter of training and just not picking things up in the first place. Recognizing them, letting them be there, but we don't have to pick it up. So this is a skill to learn. And we learn it through just coming to know the heart, our own minds, in reaction, in response, in situations, in the present moment. And allowing just that awareness to comprehend. And we don't have to intellectualize it, we don't have to strategize, we don't have to write a thesis about it, but trust that you learn through the heart's experience. This is painful. This leads to release, this kind of learning. All the while taking the, or recollecting the power of the refuges, the Buddha of awareness, the power of awareness, that refuge in awareness, being a light unto ourselves, a refuge unto ourselves. Using the teachings as a refuge, both in the form it comes to us outwardly, but in our own understanding of that Dhamma as it unfolds in our own experience. This is refuge in Dhamma. And I like to see, reflect on refuge in Sangha as the embodiment of Buddha Dhamma. So the full embodiment of that knowing mind, presence with the way things are, being willing to be fully embodied, and then that to me is the place of compassion, where compassion is born. Compassionate action in the world. This is what Sangha is about. Compassionate action. But come from that place. Buddha knowing the Dhamma. Willing to be awake. To learn. So then that refuge place that is a place where the power of trust allows us to abide. Trust in the Buddha's teaching is saddha. It has three words we can apply to it: faith, trust, and confidence. It's not a blind faith, but this kind of willingness. And then when you learn to abide there, it actually becomes more of a tangible, a kind of a tangible abiding. But in essence, it's a non-abiding. You're not abiding attached to anything. This is another way of talking of Nibbana. It's a place of no abiding. Or again, unestablished consciousness. So these are just a few of my reflections, my own personal reflections around how to use these teachings and how it can unfold or express itself in one person's practice. So what I say is just for you to reflect on rather than to take as, I was going to say God's truth, Buddha's truth. I obviously want to present the truth of the Buddha as closely as possible, but these reflections are coming from my own experience, So take it in that vein. And I think I'll finish there tonight and hope that it's been useful in some way.